It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
It's episode 140 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week I've got a great interview with Derek Fish, the creator of a comic that you should be reading if you aren't already, called The Well Keeper. This book is the tale of a young girl by the name of Zoe. She's the latest in a long line of women known as Well Keepers, who are charged with the task of guarding the living energies of the Earth itself. And she's empowered to communicate and control those very forces. Of course, evil can't let that go on for very long, so she's being chased by the Withering Man, an excellent villain as well. We talk about how the book came to be, how many issues have come out, and how you can access this great comic. There's a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show. Okay, I want to welcome to the podcast Derek Fish, creator of a great little book called The Well Keeper that I got a chance to log into when I was at the Florida SuperCon recently. How are you doing, Derek?
I'm doing okay. And yourself?
Doing well, Derek. And I have to tell the story how I got involved in your book. I was going around the artist's area, and there was your table with this great little book sitting there. And I said, well, what I'll do is I'll get one and have a look at it and see what happens. So I got one and went back and read it, and then I said, wait a minute, I got to see some more. I went back and got a couple more issues, and then after went back and sat and read those, went back and read, got some more. So I think pretty well caught up. Issue 10 is the most recent one, right?
Yep, that is the most recent issue.
Okay, so I'm actually caught up. So that's kind of funny how as I read more, I had to read more. And so it's kind of great when a book grabs your attention like that. And that's what The Well Keeper did to me.
Awesome.
Do you want to tell people a little bit about what The Well Keeper is about?
Well, certainly. The elevator spiel, as it were, is that The Well Keeper is the story of a young woman named Zoe, who upon turning 16 inherits a power passed down from mother to daughter throughout the generations. This power connects her to the life energy of the planet, enabling her to communicate with, control natural forces, plant life, and animals. The problem is that her grandmother had a son, not a daughter, so this power skipped a generation. So Zoe is inheriting these gifts without knowing what they are or where they're coming from or why this is all happening to her. And now she's on the run from a dark force called the Withering Man that's trying to destroy her to end the lineage of Well Keepers.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting to me is also the fact that you've done this. The covers are color, but the inside's black and white.
Yes.
Was that intentional? Did you want to work in black and white as a medium? Did you find it was less expensive that way? Why did you decide to do this in black and white?
A little from column A, a little from column B. Obviously, yes, there is an expense involved in coloring, in print coloring, that would significantly raise the price of the book. Also, it would make it that much, it would double or triple the amount of time each issue took to get done. While I color the covers myself, it's not something that I enjoy doing as much as the regular black and white artwork. So that was another factor in wanting to go to black and white. Also, I really do have a love of black and white comics. Some of my favorite work, looking at the old Savage Sword of Conan, John Buscema and Alfredo Alcala work is just stunning. Bernie Wrightson's Frankenstein, the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles were a huge influence on me. A lot of my favorite comic art, to me, just looks better in black and white. I mean, if you can find examples of almost anything Al Williamson ever inked in black and white before it got colored, it just, to me, it looks better 90% of the time.
DC also does an occasional thing called Batman Black.
I'm a huge fan of those.
Yeah, those are great fun, too. You get to see artists actually do something in black and white for a change. It was fun to see, like, Bruce Timm do that in black and white. So there was a lot of interesting things to do that. And one of the things before we get into, I want to talk a lot about the characters. The art, one of the most noticeable things about Zoe is her eyes.
Okay.
And I'm just kind of interested in that. When you draw, do you tend to do that with characters? Do you tend to focus on, like, or make one attribute stand out like that?
I've always been fairly obsessed with how I draw eyes and drawing eyes in general. I mean, if there's a scrap of paper at my desk when I'm working, it'll probably have a dozen or so eyes on it. Just, I just, you know, I mean, not to use the old cliche of, you know, the eyes are the window to the soul, but they really are. I mean, they are how you express character, emotion, mood. I mean, that's one of the reasons she's got those enormous saucer eyes, that very, you know, animated Disney princess gigantic eyes, because you can just express that much more the bigger the eyes get. And in a book where I made conscious decisions early on to not use narratives or thought balloons, I wanted it to be something where, you know, you didn't have some omniscient person telling the reader what was happening. If I couldn't pull it off by the pictures and the dialogue, then I wasn't doing something right the way I felt about it. And the big eyes helped with that.
Well, one of the things that gripped me about it, because, you know, she's a, as a female, you know, you're kind of drawn to a woman's eyes, it seems like. And her eyes just, they're so expressive compared to, like, other characters and female characters in comics. And it really just drew me in when I started reading it, to see the way that you use the eyes to express what she's feeling.
I really appreciate that. I put a lot of effort into the idea that even though she is young, I wanted her to have the sense of old eyes, that even though she's young, because of what's happening to her, she's seen a lot already. And so that experience is in there, that those feelings are in there, and I really wanted to be able to have pages without dialogue. I mean, I think the first six pages of the first issue only have, like, the occasional grunt of dialogue in it. And I needed to tell as much of that as possible just with her expression and body language.
That's a great way to do it. You know, one of the things about comics that drives me crazy occasionally is that they do a lot of texting. You know, a writer feels like they've got to get their number of words quota met, or else they're not quite telling the story the way that they should. But there are times, and it's great that you're a writer-artist type person, that you can understand when it's time to tell something and when it's time to just let the images do the telling.
Well, it is a tricky balance, and I'll tell you, there is an early version of the first issue of The Wellkeeper that I actually did a preview print of for the very few people lucky enough to have the early sketchbook, where Zoe wouldn't shut up those first seven pages. And I was very uncomfortable with myself at that time. I was really nervous. You know, I'd been doing comic strips for a few years, and I was really used to wordy characters explaining everything. And, I mean, I literally was like, oh, no, I've fallen. I'm rolling down the hill. You know, I mean, she was narrating everything out loud. And it was just, I reread it, and I'm like, oh, my God, this is just so sad.
Oh,
it's like a horrible, one of those like horrible 60s virtually animated radio cartoons where characters would be, you know, I am punching you. I have been punched. Curses. The punch has hit my face. And then a loud sound effect.
Oh, no. Well, it's much better that you've done
it. John McLeod there.
Now, it's much better the way that you're doing it, because, you know, the dialogue versus the images, you know, the old adage is show us, don't tell us. And I'm really glad that you're doing that, because, man, it really makes for a much more powerful reading experience.
Thank you.
And not only that, you can draw expressions as well as action, too. I think that's a good thing. Not everybody can do that, and I do harp on the fact that I like to see that. So that was one of the things that drew me into the book as well, was that you were able to make the facial expressions gripping as well as the action when things happened. You know, you understood what was going on as well as you were drawn into the dynamic aspect of it.
Well, I mean, I kind of come from a very old school thinking that, you know, kind of like with a movie, you should be able to understand what's happening in that movie if you've turned the sound on mute. You know, you should be able to have a good idea of what's happening in your comic book if no letters are down. And, you know, that's something that I think starting in, like, maybe the, I don't know, the mid-90s, started to get a little bit lost in the glut of giant splash page comics. You know, which I got drawn into as much as anyone else, but a lot of artists ended up coming into the industry not really being as firm storytellers as they probably should be, and, you know, need to go back and pick up on some of the lessons from the masters in that regard.
I wish more people felt that way.
And also, I mean, I have the benefit of designing everything in the book to be somewhat cartoony. And I know that word gets tossed around a lot in comics as a negative, which that's one of my bigger pet peeves, that somehow the word cartoony is a bad thing. But, you know, I learned a lot from animation, studying animation, learning animation, and all that. And by having a little bit more cartoony characters, it makes it a little bit easier to show a broader range of expressions and subtleties without having to be so stuck into the structures of anatomy that have to be accurate. I mean, Zoe has an anatomy. It's just impossible. Her head is almost as large as half of her body. I mean, but it stays consistent, at least.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're younger, your head is one of the bigger parts of the body. So that didn't really bother me at all when I saw that. Now, why don't we go ahead and get into Zoe's character? Sure. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about her? How old is she?
She's 16.
You know, she's 16. Okay. Any idea where this story is located, where she's living?
Actually, yeah. The book takes place in somewhat mythically made up versions of towns in New Jersey. The town in the first issue that you can actually see on the wellkeeper.com, the website, there's a preview of the first issue where you see this little boardwalk town, and it's called Roosevelt Beach.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a made-up town based very tightly on Point Pleasant, New Jersey, where I spent a summer when I was in junior high. And my family spent the summer up there, and I really enjoyed the whole environment. And so that town is based very specifically on Point Pleasant, New Jersey. Just, I didn't want to say, hey, here's Point Pleasant, New Jersey, because then there are people that live in Point Pleasant, New Jersey, and my memory of what it looked like 25 years ago will not line up with what it looks like now. So I wanted it to look like my memory, so I called it Roosevelt Beach, naming it after my high school.
Okay.
And
now, at the beginning,
takes place in the rest of New Jersey, in rural New Jersey, when they move out from the beach.
Oh, cool. Now, at the beginning, we actually see Zoe. She's being attacked.
Yes.
And, of course, that's one way. You draw us in with the action right off the bat. Mm-hmm. I always like to tell the story about picking up a Nancy Drew book. And the first words that you read are, she couldn't believe the car was headed straight for her.
Mm-hmm.
And at that moment, you're like, what? What? What's going on? And then next thing you know, you're 5-10 pages into it already. And that's what's kind of happening with your book. What you've done is you've drawn us in because we feel for her that she's being chased and attacked the first time we see her. So I thought that was a great way to start.
Thanks. That actually took me almost 6 months to make that decision. The first issue took forever, as most first issues do. Originally, the book opened with Sebastian going to work, and I realized it was going to be the better part of 18 pages before anything happened. And about 10 pages before you even see Zoe, who is the main character.
Mm.
So the readers will then, you know, be reading this book and assume Sebastian's the main character. And he is a main character. He's the secondary lead character. Was it Deuteragonist, I think? I'm not sure. But Zoe is the main character. So not showing her right from the beginning seemed a little awkward. Again, it was a dull opening and I wanted to grab people's attentions. So really, that was kind of me taking from the old Bond movie formula of opening at the end of another adventure.
Mm-hmm.
So that you're not just going to be like sitting there waiting a half an hour for something to happen. I decided just to come in towards the end of her escape, of her initial escape from the villains. And, you know, I would be able to go back in and lead to what got her there later through some exposition and storytelling. But start it in a way that, you know, at least gives you an idea of the threat that's going on.
Mm-hmm. Now, what nationalities are Zoe made up of? Do you have any idea about that?
I actually do.
Okay.
One of the ideas that's paramount in The Wellkeeper, and if you notice in the issue zero, did you read Abele's tale?
Mm-hmm.
Where that's the first human Wellkeeper is a young African girl named Abele. And it's made clear throughout that all Wellkeepers are the same lineage. So they're very much nomadic as a general concept. They wander the earth, solving problems, learning about it, you know, doing their jobs as Wellkeepers, maintaining the balance of life. So they don't ever stay in one place for too long. So Wellkeepers are just a gigantic stew. Zoe, most specifically, is Greek on her father's side and therefore her grandmother's side. It's Zoe Kostopoulos.
Mm-hmm.
And on her mother's side, her mother's name was Alina Gonzalez. So she's half Hispanic and half Greek.
Mm. Well, that's a lightning combination right there. But she'd be very interesting to talk with and to get to know, because that kind of a combination is pretty fiery, seems like.
It would seem to be a fiery combination, but Zoe is actually more often than not quite reserved. And that partly has to come with how she was raised, and that really hasn't been touched on too much in the series so far. Unfortunately, one of the disadvantages that I'm having with the first story that I really love to do more to expand upon is we never actually get to see Zoe live a normal life. We only ever see her within the confines of this adventure, which has been a little bit limiting. And when I go back and reread my own work just to make sure where I'm, you know, got to keep track of where you're heading with the story, I'm like, you know, we got to see a little bit of Sebastian's everyday life before the proverbial poop hits the fan. Well, we got to see pretty much only one panel of Zoe living a normal life before everything went crazy.
Now, the second time we see her, you know, Sebastian is at work and he's throwing out garbage. And she happens to be dumpster diving because apparently she's looking for food. And, of course, he works for like a food type place.
Yeah, it's a little pizza kiosk down at the beach on the boardwalk.
Now, why was she doing that? Was it that she – at that point, was she not living with her grandmother? What was going on at that point?
Well, in the first issue, picks up after the – well, not to give any spoilers, but after the villain of the book, a character called the Withering Man, has already put her on the run. So she's been running, trying to find her grandmother, and she knows where her grandmother lives, but she doesn't know how to drive yet or anything, and you can only hop on the backs of trains so many times before you got to get off the train and run through towns. So she's been on her own for, you know, a few days, you know, at this point. So she's real tired, she's haggard, and she's trying to find some food, and she's trying to not be seen, and that's the important thing. Is that she's really nervous about being seen because she doesn't know the nature of what it is that's hunting her or where it is. So she's just terrified and doesn't necessarily trust anyone at this point. She's hiding. So she's going through alleys and she's going through, you know, the dumpster of a pizza place figure. A lot of people don't eat their crusts. They'll throw some crust away. So that's what she was looking for.
Wow. See, there's again, we feel sympathy for her, you know, what she's going through. The first issue comes to a really touching conclusion, to a point. We get to see Sebastian. He actually feels for her, you know, and sorry that they had sort of an abrupt meeting at the beginning. He tracks her down. And when they are actually in the house where she's kind of staying for a couple of days, just trying to get her bearings, he stays with her. And they wake up, he's seated, and her head is in his lap, which I thought that was awfully touching kind of thing. That was just, you know, that was kind of a nice thing. But, you know, some kids are like that. Not every kid is. But it speaks a lot to Sebastian's character about that. Well, I wondered if you'd talk a little bit about him, too.
Absolutely. Some people took that as a romantic gesture, but it was never really intended as a romantic gesture. Sebastian's actually about 3 years younger than Zoe. He's about 13, 14, give or take. I mean, he'd have to be old enough to have a job. But he is younger than Zoe. It was never intended as anything like a romantic thing. Just he went out to throw the garbage out at his job, and he saw this girl with, you know, the biggest, saddest eyes on the planet stealing garbage. She took off, and he took a chance that she might come back. And so he left out his leftovers from dinner the night before for her. And that's how, you know, he kind of like left that as a little peace offering. And they ended up meeting and talking when he tracked her down to that house, which actually for horror aficionados is a reference from the movie Halloween. The house is designed to look like the Myers house in Halloween, down to me saying that it was being sold by Loomis Realty. I like to put in little things like that. But yeah, so they're in that house and she's exhausted. And even by herself, she's been squatting in this, you know, house for sale on the beach. But how do you sleep when you're literally being chased by a monster? So she has the first moment in that scene to let her guard down. She feels comfortable enough around this boy. And there's a certain degree that gets revealed throughout the series that a part of Wellkeepers is their abilities are direct empathy. So if she's in a room with you, she knows whether or not she can trust you. It's just an inherent thing. There's a few times in the first issue where she uses her powers subconsciously. When Sebastian busts his nose falling, she stops it from bleeding. And it's never really, I don't draw too much attention to it, but little things like that. The fact that she just has a certain empathy of understanding that Sebastian is completely innocent, that he does just want to help her. He's somebody who needs help, and he feels like he's in a position to do something about it. So he just sits with her for a little while and lets her sleep and figures, okay, this is cool, but I got to get home sooner. My mom's going to freak out.
Now, of course, we get towards the end of the book, we do begin to see the Withering Man.
Yes.
Who, you know, the great thing about villains is you need to have a really nasty villain to make you feel even more sympathy for the main character. And the Withering Man is quite the nasty. Do you want to talk about how you developed him and what the philosophy is behind
Absolutely.
The Withering
Man? Absolutely. The Withering Man actually is a character that I created all the way back in 1996 for another comic book. It was a superhero book I was working on, self-publishing. And he was just some kind of generic supernatural villain, but the appearance was virtually identical to what he is now. And even back then, I didn't have a name for him that was any good. I ended up calling him the Odd Man, and that just was silly. But I loved the visual, and I just kept a track of that visual because it succeeded in being what I really think a villain, a scary villain, should be, which is generally scary removed from any context. It's a problem and a pet peeve I have with, like, say, here's an example, not really a villain, but Batman. When I watch The Dark Knight, the Christian Bale, Heath Ledger film, at no point is Batman to me actually scary, especially when you see him standing under fluorescent lights and he's talking like this. But he's inherently supposed to be frightening to criminals. We accept that as comic book fans, that Batman is scary. When he appears, criminals are intimidated. Mm-hmm. It works in the comic books. It works in the cartoons. But to me, it does not work in live action. He's just not frightening once you get a look at him.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to, you know, and to a certain degree, using horror film tropes as well. It's like, you know, most of your good classic 80s horror film slasher villains would be intimidating if you saw them out of context and you didn't know what they were. You had no movie to base them on. But if you saw Jason Voorhees or Michael Myers just standing there under almost any scenario, you would be disconcerted. If you didn't know what that was supposed to be, you'd be, what is this masked figure? What is he doing? What's his story? And I wanted the Withering Man to be that, to be something that if you were walking down the street and you turned around and this guy was standing there, you would be scared. And then if he did anything, he'd be doubly scared, just completely removed. And so I kept the costume and the concept. And when I started developing the Wellkeeper, it just was a natural pull this out of my portfolio and tweak it a little bit to make it work for the new concept.
Well, it's interesting you call him the Withering Man because his abilities seem to be diametrically opposed to her abilities.
They literally are diametrically opposed. In the 7th, I believe, issue, I pretty much established that the Wellkeepers initially were created to oppose the Withering Man. The Withering Man is, for lack of a better term, the embodiment of death given form and will and hunger. So it exists purely to end life and feed off of that ending of life. That's what it thrives upon, and the Wellkeeper is a font of life. She's the guardian of life. And that's the idea, is that, I mean, there was a conscious decision on my part, too, because whenever I mention the premise, a lot of people will say that, oh, well, there's a lot of environmental messages in there, but I try to keep away from the environmental messages or the political messages and keep it on the more mystical level. Zoe's not Captain Planet. I don't want to do, you know, a short story where she teaches kids about recycling. It's her concern is more when things like the Withering Man pop up, her job is to make sure that they don't disrupt the balance of the planet. You know, so that's kind of where that falls into play.
Now, as we go along, we've talked a lot about the first issue because I wanted people to understand, you know, what kinds of things will happen and what you'll see when you get it. As we go along, the characters sort of develop. We get to see also the grandmother. She appears at some point. Other characters appear. Like there's a policeman who begins to play an important role in this, in the series as it goes. The thing I like about it is enough happens in an issue that keeps you feeling like it was satisfying, but then you get to the end, you still want more. Which is the way to do this book. I just think that you did such a great job on that. That's what kept me going back to the table all the time.
Well, I mean, I'm a huge fan of stories that, I mean, every issue should have at least one core piece of meat for you to eat. The steak of the issue where you learn something or something happens that moves the story forward or gives you background information. Whatever the core of that story is, there should be at least one major one and one minor subplot going around it, be it the villain side, what's happening there, what's happening with grandmother or Sebastian or any of the other animals that are involved. And then at the end, somehow, even if there isn't necessarily a massive cliffhanger, I mean, there's a couple of issues where the only cliffhanger side of it was that the villain was watching or something. I think issue three ends like that, I believe, or four, where the only real cliffhanger is that we now know that when the animals are returning home, the Withering Man knows where they're going. But, you know, sometimes it's like issue one where they literally just open the door and there he is, dun, dun, dun. I love cliffhangers. I mean, they're just exciting. They get you fired up. They make you want to read that next issue. They're fun. I don't ever want the book to have a lackluster, mediocre ending where you're just like, oh, well, I read that comic book.
See, that's what drew me to it, was that every time I get to the place, well, now what? I have to know what happens next. You know, kind of thing. And I think that is, to me, like the ultimate in storytelling. I think you did a really good job on that.
Thank you.
Now, let's talk about where we are. Now, you said there are 10 issues out now.
Yes.
As we stand, if people want to get a hold of the Wellkeeper, how do they go about doing that?
I'm local in the Tampa area, and there's a few shops that carry it. Most specifically, if you're in the Tampa area, Heroes Haven on Gun Highway has the series. Heroes Landing in Clermont, Florida carries the book. But the best way to get it is either any convention or store appearance that I advertise on Facebook or the website itself, which is www.thewellkeeper.com. There's a button marked store, and you can order the books directly from the printer.
Now, the company you must have created it in order to do it is Big Pond Comics.
Yes.
I kind of like the name of that. In other words, that storytelling is going to be in a big pond, not a very small, limited thing.
It's also a pun because my last name is Fish, so it's I'm a little fish in a big pond.
Okay. So now you've been doing other comics work before. This isn't your first comic. Do you want to tell people what things you had done in the past?
Starting in 2001, I did an online comic strip called Dandy and Company, which is still online at dandyandcompany.com, and that ran for the better part of 10 years. So I've got a lot of material for that. I'm actually getting ready to publish the last collection of online strips from a couple of years ago, and that'll be the 728-page book. And that was very much a whimsical Looney Tunes meets Calvin and Hobbes meets Peanuts meets the Savage Dragon. in that, like, it was a comic. At its start, it was literally the slightly skewed misadventures of a dog and his boy, and it started to encompass literally anything I felt like telling in the story at the time. So if I wanted to draw an alien invasion, that became a storyline. I wanted them to become superheroes. That became a story. I could do anything in that book for a while, and I did that for a very long time. And again, those are all still available online as well. I did a science fiction comic called Scarred World, The Chronicles of Aegis. Four issues of that were self-published through Big Pond back in 2004. And that was kind of left hanging after the fourth issue. With a lot of self-published comics, there's often, you know, the finances involved. And that was a full-color book, so it was much more expensive. And each issue took me almost a year to complete. So that kind of fell by the wayside after a while. I'd love to finish it at some point. And I've done other work as well, short stories and pieces for the Image Comics, PvP, and the Perhaponauts. I've done backup stories for Red 5 Atomic Robo, and most recently just finished up a backup story for J.C. De La Torre's Star Mage, which is at IDW, and we also have a new book coming out from a startup comic company called Hashtag Comics called Carpe Noctum, which is a vampire comic, and I just finished the first issue of that.
Cool.
So I'm trying to keep busy.
Sounds like it. So now, 10th issue, where are we going to go from here? Issues, imagine when you get this far, you're probably going to have 12 issues?
Yep, it is a 12-issue series. It's broken into three acts of four. So the first four issues, you know, there's kind of a natural break at the end of each four issues. So that, for lack of a better term, we're right now in the middle of Return of the Jedi. You know, 1 through 4 was A New Hope. 5 through 8 was The Empire Strikes Back, and now we're smack in the middle of Return of the Jedi, but without Ewoks.
Okay. Okay. Now, issue 11. When's that going to hit?
I'm shooting for the end of September. I'm working on that right now, and I'm hoping to premiere that at PalmCon in West Palm Beach.
Okay. Now, how long after the con happens will it be available on the website?
It'll become available on the website as soon as, because I have to send it to get printed from the printer, Kablam. And as soon as the files are available for order, I put the link up on the website and on the blog and on Facebook. So it can be ordered as a PDF download or a print copy.
Okay, excellent. Now, as far as issue 12, Do you have any ideas when that's going to, when this whole thing's going to wrap up?
I am aiming to have that, the full series, issue 12, wrapped up by MegaCon. I mean, that gives me more than a few months, and issue 12 will most likely be larger than standard issue size, just to keep everything thematically fit. But it's all plotted out. I don't actually script the books until after I've drawn them. So what I write for myself is really outlines. I have everything outlined and plotted so that I know where each issue has to begin, where each issue has to end, and what the major beats that have to be in each issue. But then from there, I storyboard it, lay it out, thumbnails, and then go right into the page and draw it. That way the process still stays fresh for me, and I don't ever get bored feeling like I've now written this comic 6 times.
Now, MegaCon happens like in February or March, right?
I believe so. I think it's March. It might even be April this year, in which case, by then, I would hope I would not only have the 12th issue, but the omnibus of all 12.
Oh, cool. Okay, that'd be fun to get. It'd be nice to buy the whole story all at one time.
Yeah.
That would be really great.
Well, it's written as such. It was conceived of as a very concise beginning, middle, end story.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so as far as other things, I imagine this is keeping you pretty busy, but are there other projects you work on that we should be aware of as well?
Well, there's the one I was mentioning earlier, Carpe Noctem, which will be coming out next year as well from Hashtag mm-hmm. Studios, that I'm co-writing and drawing. Mm-hmm. When The Wellkeeper is done, I haven't actually decided officially what I'm going to be doing next in terms of self-publishing. I've got a whole bunch of ideas that I'm thinking of doing one-shots as, just to kind of test the waters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm considering other crowdfunding ideas like Indiegogo or even Kickstarter for possibly mm-hmm. funding a second arc for The Wellkeeper, because I do have lots of additional stories.
Oh, good.
Even the possibility if the book finds its feet and finds a broader market, because it's doing well right now, just in the mm-hmm. tiny little, you know, circles that I'm selling it in through the internet, through... Mm-hmm. local stores and things like that, but not quite doing well enough to be my full-time job. Mm-hmm. You know, if I could get it to that level, then I could conceivably take this full as an ongoing series, because I've got the world built out and I'd love to examine it more.
Oh, that would be fun. It would be great to see that come to pass, because you can tell reading the book that you have more in mind, that there is, you know, a well-written story. You can sense that there's other things happening, and that's the way I get with The Wellkeeper. I get this feeling that there are a lot of other things that could be happening that you have in mind that hopefully down the road we'll get to see.
Well, I've been trying to not be very blunt about it, because I don't want it to be to where people feel like they're being hinted at something and then feel like if it never happens, why, what the heck? Again, I'm using Star Wars kind of as an example. Like, mm-hmm. imagine the first Star Wars. Imagine that there was never any sequels or prequels. All we had was that first movie. Well, that movie is complete unto itself. We don't mm-hmm. need to see the Clone Wars that were talked about in the past. If we never find out that Darth Vader is Luke's father, then the story in Star Wars is simply that he was a pupil of Obi-Wan and he killed Luke's father, and now Luke is going to fight him.
Mm-hmm.
But he saves the day, but the villain gets away, and there could be more. But if there's never any more... then the story is complete onto itself, and that's kind of how I want this entire story to be, that when you get to the end of issue 12, you'll know, okay, this is what's happening, this is where Zoe is and where Sebastian is and what's happened to the Withering Man and LaLuja, Zoe's grandmother, and Officer Winston, the police officer you're referring to, and his family. You'll know where everyone's at the end of issue 12, and if you never see another story, there's no giant plot holes left for you, but there's plenty of seeds for potential adventures.
Mm-hmm. And that's fun. That to me is the greatest thing in a comic. If you can make it so that there's a lot of possibilities, mm-hmm. that to me is such a great thing, because so many stories. And on the other hand, too, it's great to have a self-contained story.
Yeah.
But if you have enough possibilities and enough storytelling to continue on, and they're good ideas, then mm-hmm. that's the thing to me, is to go ahead and do them. And that's what I would encourage you with The Wellkeeper, is keep going. Because, like I said, it was a great book that had me gripped.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
Those are all the projects you're working on?
Right now, yeah. I'm trying to keep myself focused on this, because, you know, every now and again I'll get some idea and I'll go crazy, do some concept drawings and sketches and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some other books I'd like to... flex certain muscles on, some superhero concepts I'm working on developing with a friend of mine and writer Martin Dunn with CAE Studios that I've joined forces with to kind of combine resources and creativity. We've got some superhero ideas we've been playing with that scratch that itch, because it's funny, you know, I've wanted to draw superhero comics my whole life, and yet in self-publishing, I have yet to do that. Mm-hmm. Aside from parody versions when I was doing my comic strip. You know, I'm doing, you know, broad fantasy adventure books and sci-fi books. Now I'm doing vampire comics. And it's funny that all these different things, it's like I think I might need to scratch my men in tights itch.
Oh, okay. Okay, that would be an interesting thing to see, because you have a very, in a good way, adult way with characters. Nice. That, you know, you approach them. They're not two-dimensional. They're actually three-dimensional, which sometimes comics really lack.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have to say, people who listen to this podcast know I am a big proponent of female leads in comics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when one of the things that gripped me about The Wellkeeper was the fact that you had this very interesting female character who was involved. She wasn't, you know, women tend to be certain kinds of characters in comics. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll tend to be maternal. You know, there's something about a lead character that must always be maternal, a lot of my female friends tell me. But to me, what you've done with her is you have given Zoe, and, you know, the other women too, the grandmother and all these other people in the book, they're much more than just quote-unquote average comics women. And to me, that is a huge accomplishment. I wish there were more, believe me, that were that way. I get so frustrated. You know, when you read Storm, I mean, what is Storm but, you know, a raging warrior kind of stuff? And that's good, because that's different from the maternal.
Mm-hmm.
But she needs to be a little more well-rounded to me, but not physical
sense. Yeah, I think
sense,
in the 80s is when she was being written possibly her best. Where she was balancing that maternal earth goddess with the warrior, you know, during the Mohawk period, where she was trying to find herself.
Because
that's the funny thing. It's like, that was her as a character trying to find herself outside of the roles that others defined for her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and she loses her powers and has to discover the kind of lead. I mean, that was actually really great characterization. But then after a while, like, people just forgot there was this awesome character there and wrote her as one or the other. Just as almost as a visual icon.
Well, she lost her powers, and she got them back, and then she was a leader.
It's almost after she got them back that she stopped being as interesting in a weird way.
She got her powers back and lost her personality.
Almost. But, I mean, as a reader, I've always been drawn towards well-written characters, regardless of gender, but a lot of very interesting, strong female characters, which is such a, you know, it's almost a blanket term at this point, strong female characters. And it's like, that doesn't just mean, you know, for some reason, I think it becomes synonymous. The term strong female character means physically, literally strong. Look, she takes no poop. I mean, to me, strong female character simply means a female character that's well written. She could be the weakest character in the book, but if she's well defined, she's still a strong female character.
Not necessarily physical strength. Like Painkiller Jane, for example, was described to me, and it's, sorry if this offends anybody, but as a man with tits. But I didn't see her that way. I thought that she was actually something different from what I'm used to seeing women being. And so to me, that was a big plus, you know, to see her do that.
Well,
and with
Jim
Zoe, Calcanati, I really...
is exceptional at writing female characters that buck stereotypes or rides. I mean, the work that he did with, I believe, Justin Gray is his writing partner on most projects, like with Power Girl. Now, it helped that Amanda Connor can draw the heck out of Power Girl and to put so much personality into it. But they took the stereotype of her. What is her number one attribute everyone thinks of is she's got big boobs in the boob window. And they just embraced it. And it's like, we're not going to try to change this part of it. We're just going to say, who is this person, regardless of what you think of her appearance? And created a character that was largely two-dimensional before they got their hands on her and did some awesome things with it.
Well, see, what you've done with Zoe to me is you've made her three-dimensional. She lives and breathes as far as I know.
Thank you.
In my imagination. And one of the reasons I want to support this book so much is because of the fact that you've done such a good job on her and built this strong world around her, which is really engaging and interesting. And I just have to tell you, I really love it, and I wish that this can keep go on for quite a long time because I'm really enjoying it.
Well, I thank you very much. I really appreciate that, you know, you're enjoying it that much and getting out of it a lot of what it is I was hoping people would get out of the book, you know, in terms of the depth of the characters and the characterization and all that. With Zoe, there were a lot of things I had in my mind, not just a character who, because, I mean, if you really, you think about the series without giving up any spoilers per se, it's when she's a reactionary character that things go wrong. When she's when she's running is when bad things happen. When she stands her ground, when she chooses not to let things happen to her, is when things start turning. And that was a very important decision, you know, around the fifth or sixth issue to play that in and have her start questioning her grandmother and start questioning the lessons she's being taught, and start challenging the Withering Man and his thrall. And I mean, in a weird way, like you mentioned the maternal thing, but in many ways, she is a very protective character, and that is partly by design. I mean, she is an Earth Mother stereotype to that degree. That's a part of her powers, and it's a part of nature. Being empathic is to want to protect people. But I try to take that and apply it to a more realistic way of thinking that a real person would put themselves in. And that's to a degree, even with the dialogue, the characters stammer a lot. I mean, I don't know how often you talk to kids, but you almost never get a full sentence out of anyone who has the word teen at the end of their age. You get stammering, and people made fun of it, I think, in the first Amazing Spider-Man with Andrew Garfield and Emma Watson. They had that awkward conversation in the hallway where they almost said nothing to each other and yet had a date as a result. But they were muttering the entire time, and it's like, go to the food court, listen to kids talk. They mutter, they stammer, they stutter. And so when I write the dialogue, I say everything out loud to myself to get that kind of natural cadence of the awkward way people really talk.
Just one other question comes to mind. Is The Will Keeper available like on Comixology or any of those kind of digital platforms?
It is not available on Comixology just now. I need to do the submission, but from Kablam, you can order PDF downloads of each issue.
Okay. Well, I was just kind of thinking, because a lot of people now more and more seem to be going to like Comixology and these kinds of places, like Comics Fixes and stuff
like that. Yeah, I've been a little bit behind, the part and parcel of being, you know, doing all the creative side of everything is that I frequently neglect the business side and do need to try to get it up there.
Well, I would just love to get this book in more people's hands and have them reading it, because it's a great book. You're doing a wonderful job on it, and the characters are very vibrant, and the storytelling is excellent. So I just hope that people go to thewellkeeper.com and get started on this book, because it's definitely worth your time and money.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the kudos, and I do hope that people enjoy the book as well.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
Now at MajorSpoilers.com. And that's it for this episode. Be back next time. I'll have another great interview with an excellent comics creator, something I'm sure you won't want to miss. But until then, keep reading your comics.